differences between children seems to me to be making a mistake for parents, for teachers, for the educational system, for society.
Over its murky 100-year history, we've seen the science of intelligence swing from genetics, sometimes as eugenics, to the dream of a levelled playing field for all in the post-war era. In the 21st century, perhaps we've finally settled somewhere in the middle. In the final part of this series, I'll be questioning if we're ready to start thinking about intelligence with a mature view that brings both nature and nurture together. And I'll be asking a very simple question. What does this all mean for education?
Intelligence, born smart, born equal, born different was presented by Adam Rutherford. The producer was Anna Buckley. In just a moment, a 90th birthday profile of conductor Sir Neville Mariner. First, we find out what's coming up in today's You and Yours with Shari Val.
I'm sitting down, and I've been sitting down all morning. New research says a third of us wouldn't even consider walking for more than 20 minutes. Government advice recommends 2.5 hours a week to stay healthy, and 60% of adults don't manage that. So what's it going to take to get us moving? The threats to our health don't seem to. Keeping up with lithe youngsters in lurid lycra seems a definite no-no. So we'd like to hear your ideas. You can call us on 03700 100 444 or email us at youandyours@bbc.co.uk.
First on Radio 4, in 1958, Neville Mariner created the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, one of the world's most famous chamber orchestras. As conductor and orchestra, they have become the most recorded musical partnership in history. Last month, Sir Neville celebrated his 90th birthday, and many of those musicians he's worked with over the years have been paying tribute. Now on Radio 4, Sue McGregor looks back on his life in music in Sir Neville at 90.
It's another working day for an orchestra, but this time musicians are gathering at Henry Wood Hall in London, opening their scores and warming up their instruments. Today, this rehearsal is special. It's the last day before a birthday concert for a man who's one of their own. He arrives in a bright, stripy shirt, greets old friends, and then steps onto the podium. They know they're in safe hands and in for some fun.
Look at the years that Neville has worked and still going strong with the same enthusiasm and the same regard for excellence.
Everything he does is very tasteful and just great music making.
It's not just an ordinary event, an Academy concert, it's special.
And I can't believe that Neville's 90. He neither looks it or acts it.
Birthday tributes there from Dame Janet Baker, violinist Joshua Bell, pianist Murray Pariah and timpanist Tristan Fry.
Someone once said that you could recognise the sound of the Academy after listening for less than 30 seconds. It has a special sound. Sir Neville Mariner, how would you describe that sound?
Well, I think it was always our ambition to have a certain vitality in the sound at all times and a clarity of texture. And in this room where we are at the moment, we agonised over this for 2 years before we'd given any sort of concert at all, how we would produce the sort of sound that we were looking for. And it's to do with texture, of course, a lot to do with the balance, and chiefly the quality of the instrumentalists that are actually playing the music.
Well, I know that you handpicked the top musicians that you could find because you wanted a special sound.
I think the sound that they made was the most important thing about them. Normally speaking, if you're auditioning, you can tell in 2 minutes if they can play their instrument. The next step is to put them in the ensemble to see if they're adjusted to playing with other people. And the third thing is to take them on tour to see if they're unbearable.
The genius of Neville is that he got those players together, absolutely top-notch players of every kind, and wanted to do repertoire, which, as chamber orchestra, they could absolutely wallow in.
Neville Mariner is the most recorded British conductor ever, second only to Herbert von Karajan worldwide. He started out as a violinist, making his first solo broadcast when he was only 12, and at 16 won a scholarship to the Royal College of Music. His studies were interrupted by war service, but then he returned to the college, and in 1946 he sent a letter of application to the BBC, which paid off.
The BBC, in lots of ways, provided me as a violin player in those days with a living. There was a time when young players used to get half an hour in the morning to do a recital, and I think I must have done half a dozen of those. And I was part of the Martin String Quartet that for years played for the third programme. And occasionally I used to be called in to play for a programme called William. William was Just William, you know,
the Just William
programmes, which I remember the signature tune. And I remember it was 6 guineas for about 10 minutes' work. There were Thursday concerts for chamber music, Tuesday recitals. There was so much music going on, particularly in the BBC in those days, that it was really very important to us.
We have found in the BBC archives a recording of you as a member of a trio which included Alan Loveday and Anthony Hopkins, the distinguished musicologist. But this is the mid-50s, before you were famous, if you like. Let's have a listen to it. Remember making that broadcast nearly 60 years ago?
Well, not surprisingly, not at all. But I remember the trio with great affection. It was really for pleasure. We travelled the country quite widely. Tony always took his golf clubs, and late night card games were a feature of the, probably the more prominent feature of the tours, but they were very happy days.
You travelled around as cheaply as possible, which I suppose meant mostly by train to your dates, occasionally getting it wrong.
Oh dear. Yes, according to an Ibsen Tillett contract, we were playing in Newport, and we made our way to Newport, but it was a wrong Newport. The one we went to was in Wales. The one we should have been to was in the Isle of Wight or somewhere a few hundred miles away. But in fact, we did actually make it. To our horror, we arrived about more than half an hour late for the concert. And the audience had been listening to recordings. I think they were Yasha Heifetz playing something, which was rather an embarrassing contrast.
You were, in 1956, you joined the LSO, the London Symphony Orchestra, as principal second violin.
Yes.
So that was your bread and butter, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely, yes. To do with my family life, really, with a wife and two children. And the orchestra was, in those days, of course, a creditable income, because the London Symphony Orchestra was just getting into the field of recording industry, and also achieving some pretty distinguished conductors too.
In 1958, Neville and a small group of top orchestral string players joined together to play Baroque music. They dig out dusty old scores from the British Museum and have long rehearsals with intensive discussions about how to perform them. There was no conductor. Neville directed from the leader's chair. They were playing for fun. But this was pioneering work in the revival of early music and the birth of a British institution.
He used to say, Britain has two exports, Earl Grey tea and the Academy of St Martin in the Fields.
Violinist Kenneth Sillitoe, who led the Academy for over 30 years.
I would hope that he feels very gratified and proud of what has become of, as he always put it, cleaning his teeth with Baroque music, because that's how he described his very first forays into the Baroque repertoire. It was basically an antidote to symphony work, doing Bruckner, Mahler, Tchaikovsky, and he just wanted to get into that more transparent sound.
In a large symphony orchestra, although each person is important, they don't really feel that they're fundamentally necessary in the orchestra. I think they wanted more choice about the sort of sound they made, the sort of repertoire they played, and the way they rehearsed.
Obviously, the name for your orchestra, the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, came from the church just off Trafalgar Square in London. But how did you come to rehearse in that church in the first place?
The convenience was that Jack Churchill was the organist of the Church of St Martin in the Fields, and he was also our keyboard player for the group of players that didn't have a name in that time. And it was Jack who suggested that we did a concert. And the vicar said, Well, you know, in the 17th, 18th century around here in St. Martin's Lane, there were academies of science, of literature, of medicine. They were just groups of people of similar interest who got together for pleasure. We said, OK, we are the academy. And he said, well, because you've been here so much, it'd be rather good if you mentioned the church. Academy of St. Martin. Oh, we said, much too long. What a ridiculous name. I mean, could get it on the poster. There's no room for anything else. And he said, well, I would appreciate it, if just for these concerts anyway. So we did. The name was made the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields.
Of course, the burgeoning of the fame and success of the Academy coincided with all sorts of new things happening technically in the recording world. And we found, again in the archive, a stereophonic test transmission, which was recorded on the 6th of February 1961. Let's have a listen.
The Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, leader Neville Mariner, is directed today by Dennis Stevens.
I remember that we used to work quite frequently with Dennis and for the BBC at that time, but I don't remember being part of an experiment like this. It's fascinating. I mean, I love hearing it.
That appears to be the earliest surviving recording of the Academy. In years to come, their recordings and broadcasts became so prolific that an American cartoon depicted a parrot listening to the radio. On hearing an announcement for the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, it immediately squawked, "Neville Mariner conducting."
Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, director Neville Mariner.
Sir Neville Mariner.
Neville Mariner conducting.
Neville Mariner.
Right, Neville Mariner.
Thank you, Neville Mariner, for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
That was all to come. The big breakthrough was a few weeks after that test recording, with the Academy's first LP. It was funded by an admirer all the way from Australia.
Louise Dyer. She came to a concert. We'd played St. Martin in the Fields. And she said, would you be interested in recording some of the music I've just bought with this company in Paris that prints early music? And because of her early offer to make a record, the Academy started making records. I mean, gramophone records are rather like visiting cards. You know, they go around the world and people know who you are and what you do very quickly. So it's like having a free public relations affair.
This 1969 recording of Vivaldi's Four Seasons with Alan Loveday brought spectacular success worldwide. It was their first gold disc.
You've lived in this flat, which is in a beautiful London garden square, for nearly 60 years, I think.
Indeed.
If you can take us back to nearly 60 years ago when you were rehearsing in this room, did that mean that there were about 20 musicians in the house at the time?
Indeed, they were. Really, the first duty we had as the musicians arrived was we all had to take the furniture out. It went to the hall there. There came a time when you couldn't leave the room because you couldn't get into the hall. The only thing we couldn't move was the piano, of course, but we needed the keyboard anyway. And I suppose the only other immovable things were the cats. And they used to climb the curtains here and settle on top.
This was maybe a bit of an imposition on your wife, Molly. I mean, did she have to provide food for everybody? Supper?
Absolutely, yes. So that became her first role. And
did you pay her?
No.
So they all came here, and they were all delightful, and some of them smoked on the carpet, and one had an ulcer incipient, so he kept demanding milk and pieces of bread. The worst time that ever happened was when we were doing the biggest Brandenburg, and people arrived early, Alan Civil.
He was the horn player.
Yes, very good one. But I had to put him in our bedroom while he practiced. And he said, I've never practiced in a lady's bedroom before. So I said, all right, we share it. So it's not just a lady's boudoir, Alan. And he said, ha. Huh.
Horns and oboes, really, were the first wind instruments we had. But then soon you needed trumpets and timpani. And as people went from Vivaldi and Handel and Bach on to Mozart, for instance, then Beethoven, and then Schubert, and gradually the orchestra got bigger and bigger. So then I was heading towards conducting.
I'm trying to picture how you led them without standing in front of them and waving either your hands or a baton at them. Was it with your bow?
When it's a small group like that and everyone can see you, then you can do it with quite small physical gestures, really, like leading a string quartet. Occasionally you had to wave your bow in the air, and I think this is where Pierre Monteux...
The French conductor.
He was the music director of the London Symphony Orchestra when I was playing there. He came to an Academy concert and said, Neville, that was very good, but why don't you stand up and conduct properly, like a man?
And did you take his advice straight away?
Well, yes, he was very kind. He said, I have a conducting school in America. Would you like to come to that? So I went along to his school in America.
And you were a good study.
Well, when I arrived there, almost just getting off the bus and going to the school, Monteux said, oh, Neville, what are you going to conduct this morning? And I said, well, I haven't prepared anything yet. And he said, well, conduct what we played with the London Symphony Orchestra 2 weeks ago. So I conducted that, and he didn't say a word. And I did the same the next day and the day after that. And eventually, about the fourth day, the telephone rang. And he said, Neville, yes, it's getting better. He said, but why do you stick out your behind when you want pianissimo? And I suddenly realised I was ducking every time I wanted the orchestra to play quietly.
And I think it was around that time, perhaps just after, that the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra was formed. And they wanted you to conduct them.
What they wanted was an academy in Los Angeles, and I decided not to take my violin. I just took a baton. That was 69, I think, when I started conducting really seriously.
Neville plays the blues with the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra. Americans took him to their hearts. After a decade in L.A., he was appointed music director of the Minnesota Orchestra. Local buses were emblazoned with posters proclaiming Neville Mariner, a conductor to rave about. And at 90 now, he continues to tour and to conduct orchestras around the world. But he's always maintained his association with the Academy. Their principal timpanist, Tristan Fry, also known as drummer with the classical rock fusion band Sky, has worked with Neville throughout his conducting career.
Neville has this wonderful knack of saying to one section, have a listen to what this other section are doing. So say, to the wind, have a listen to what the strings are doing underneath you while you've got that beautiful tune. And do you know, it makes such a difference, because when you think of an orchestra, we are so far apart that you don't hear what the other people are necessarily doing. Once you've heard it on its own, you then have a completely different idea of how you fit to that. It's a very cleverly thought out idea, you know, that Neville came up with.
The distinguished pianist Murray Pariah, the Academy's chief guest conductor, first performed with Neville Mariner 40 years ago.
He has no false ego, and so he can understand a soloist requesting things, and he'll try to do them at the best of his ability. But he's also aware of the final product, what will sound best. So in a way, he's a very good mediator, and he doesn't lose his temper, he doesn't get egotistical, he's very easy to work with.
One of the Bach recordings Dame Janet Baker made with Sir Neville and the Academy was awarded a Grammy in 1977, but a recording of Italian songs, which they made the following year, came at a very difficult time for them both.
My mother at the time was very ill. When we met for the recording sessions, Neville's father was also extremely ill. And I was just about to leave for one of the sessions, and she was unconscious, and I went into hospital with her. I was with her for 24 hours, and she died at the end of the 24 hours, in a way, mercifully. Then I had to take up the recording sessions again.
and we didn't know whether to go on with the recording or not. But my father died 2 days later, and it was an extraordinary week for us in the studio, both wondering, should we stop doing this or should we continue? And emotionally, it was one of the most complicated weeks, I think, that I've ever lived through as far as making a record's concerned.
We would record, and I would then in the break go off into the loo and cry and get rid of my tears and then go back again and hope that I could carry on. And this is the way we ended the session. And then, of course, he was going through exactly the same process with his father. I don't know how we ever got those sessions completed. That recording I can't listen to anymore because it is, for me, the expression of what we were both going through at the time.
Whether it transmits any of that to anyone else except us, I don't know, but certainly those sort of things are memorable moments in your life.
One of the reasons orchestral musicians, I think, love working with him is because he has this practical wisdom in the recording studio.
Andrew Keener, who's produced many of Sir Neville's recordings over the past 30 years.
Neville trusts his players and their musicianship without feeling it necessary to go into metaphor or metaphysics or extra musical illumination. It's a very practical way of making music, and the results are very exciting and very cogent. This may have led some people very wrongly to think that there's an element of deep emotional feeling which is missing from Neville's musical makeup. This couldn't be further from the truth. He just doesn't talk about it.
I think it's the first time I've ever worked with an orchestra back in the 60s where everybody used to go and listen back to the playbacks. We'd all then think, hey, maybe I should play a little bit louder there, or I should back off there a little bit, to give somebody else a chance. And I think this is where Neville was amazing, because I think he was the first conductor to get involved in how recordings happen.
He knows what sounds good on a record. He'll hear the take, he'll say, no, this isn't working, this has to be placed differently. He'll know where the mics should be. And so it's quite amazing. In a minimal amount of sessions, he can do maximum work.
And he's extremely savvy as well. I remember quite early on in our time together in the studio, and we were doing the Brahms symphonies. There was a moment in the slow movement which wasn't going right. You know, it happens. And time was short. So I said, can we go from bar 44, Neville? And he said, 25, everyone. And I thought he'd misheard me. Fatal. Of course he hadn't misheard me. I battled on. I said, no, actually, Neville, 44, please. 25, everybody, and actually, what are the... And there was a dangerous silence. And Neville said, I think you'll find it's 25, Andrew. I'd wasted the time, he'd saved it.
I believe the best-selling disc you ever made, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the soundtrack to Amadeus, the Milos Forman version of Peter Schaffer's play.
The whole thing was a sort of fantasy, in a way, that Peter and Milos and I met. I think the only place we could meet was in the airport in New York, because we were all going in different places at different times, just to agree that we'd do it. And the only stipulation I made was that we made the record in London the way the Academy plays. I didn't want it to be made in Los Angeles in a studio there. And then they came to stay with us down in Devon, just to talk about how much music we should play and where it would happen and what sort of pieces were going where.
Whose idea was it to major on Mozart's wonderful work for 13 wind players, which made such an important dramatic point in the narrative?
That was Peter, and he does that in the play as well. I mean, that is the
That's when Salieri realises that he's very ordinary and Mozart is a genius.
Absolutely, yes. It's a wonderful moment.
An oboe. A single note hanging there, unwavering. Until a clarinet took it over. Sweetened it into a phrase of such delight. This was no composition by a performing monkey. This was a music I'd never heard.
And then we came to Abbey Road Studios in London and recorded all the music before they'd shot one piece of film at all.
The day before the 90th birthday celebration concert, we had a chance to eavesdrop on Sir Neville's rehearsal of Elgar's Enigma Variations. Some former members of the Academy took part, including Sir Neville's son, the clarinetist Andrew Mariner, and Kenneth Sillitoe, who till 2 years ago was leader and artistic director.
They very kindly invited me back to lead for old time's sake, and it's a time warp. I mean, I feel as though I've never been away.
The thing I'm looking for in the brass is the tightness of those first two quavers to get us off.
You always know with Neville that he expects the absolute highest attention to excellence.
My name is John Healy. I'm a cellist. I've been in the Academy since 1985 as associate principal.
I'm Tim Brown. I'm principal horn of the Academy of St Martin's, and I've played first in 1965.
Play a little bit less. Let me see if the tuba can dominate you. Well, it's nice to hear him, that's all.
The lovely thing is that we've got about 10 people who used to play in the orchestra that come back and they're going to sit on the back desk, and there's a sense of history there as well.
I think he comes from Lincoln, and I feel he's impish, and he's still teasing people even today in rehearsal, saying, oh, I'll have the back desk of violins playing that on their own.
Just the back desk.
Somebody said to me yesterday, we won't be able to play for the tears, and, you know, it's going to be such an emotional thing.
It's celebrating Neville's 90th, but actually I fully expect we'll be here in 10 years' time celebrating his 100th in a similar way.
Violinist Joshua Bell, the Academy's new music director, also took part.
Well, it was really a wonderful atmosphere, both in the audience and stage. I mean, celebrating someone's 90th in such a way, seeing that person who's 90 years old get up there and work harder than anyone else in the room and conduct with the youthfulness of a 30-year-old, it gives inspiration to all of us. Everyone in the audience is just an amazing spectacle.
I suppose the life suits me. I mean, I think I would make a very poor retiree somehow. I think I would begin to be rather a bore and fidget a lot, and I'd want to be doing something all the time. I just enjoy playing music.
Well, seeing you didn't choose any of your own recordings for Desert Island Discs, I'm going to invite you, if I may, to choose something with which we might end this programme.
I think the opening of In the South of Elgar is quite remarkable.
And what do you remember about recording the Elgar?
I think a feeling of extreme gratitude, which I would not dream of expressing to the players themselves, about the sort of performance that they offer. Their name will not appear on the record. They may even forget they ever made it. But there's such a distinction about their contribution, which you could never express to the... I daren't express it to the orchestra. They would laugh their heads off. But subliminally, it is always there that you cannot believe these people are prepared to contribute so intensely to a joint affair like that.
Sir Neville at 90 was presented by Sue McGregor and produced by Susan Kenyon. It was a Whistledown production for BBC Radio 4, and you can hear extended interviews from the programme on the Radio 4 website. On Thursday afternoon, James Naughtie will be talking to Christos Tsolkas about his controversial book, The Slap. Should you slap a child who's misbehaving but who is not yours? Hear more in the book club on Thursday at 3:30. On Radio 4 Long Wave Now, the news and the shipping forecast. Here on FM, the news and today's You and Yours.